And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everybody. It's Dean Haglund here on the Office of Rational Exuberance. I'm above the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia Building. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with your co-host and mine, Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
The fade may not have been the most artful, but I would like to point out that I faded and controlled the music with one hand on two different controls so that I did not have to put down the cookie. The delicious, delicious cookie. Yes. Dean Haglund, have you been writing a new opening for when the show longer comes from the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, but comes from
Hollywood.
Two different hemispheres,
where the water goes in two different directions, down the toilet. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Should we do that?
Wow. We'll edit all this out.
No, we won't.
You know, often we talk about live events of the week, and tonight, of course, there's a big and tall show going on at the Last Social. Many people in from out of town, mm-hmm. many august personages, friends of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's like a Chilpack Hollywood Hour reunion to come and see you perform, or at least to just see you. Before you go to Australia,
okay.
And you are skipping. You're skipping the show that you made famous.
For months now, I've had this other event going on. I didn't realize. And as you know, we have four different hosts. So tonight it's one of the other ones who's hosting.
One of the other ones, really?
One of the other hosts.
Oh, I love that host's work.
Anyway, the point
the good news is,
yeah.
The good news, anyone within the sound of my voice will not be hearing this until after they've already gone downtown to say hi to you, so,
okay,
won't
so you know
they
what?
Be surprised.
Oh, I'm going to get there 10 now. Now you've guilted me into showing up late. I will go and I will close the show.
Wouldn't you want to? Oh, that'd be awesome.
So, right?
And tell everyone that it's because I guilted you.
Totally. I'm guilted here. I have nothing prepared. I got liquored up at an art function, and now I'm here to tell you all about it.
I just got back into town, Dean Haglund, working on that kind of hush-hush project.
Oh, yes.
Concerning the Department of Justice, because I'm not a hitman.
No, but you're doing community service somehow.
What?
Well,
that's not what it has to do with. But anyway,
sure. I
will...
maybe you're picking up garbage on the side of the 99.
Oh, my goodness. No, this is involving that time when I went to the federal courts.
And all right.
Remember when I was accused by one of the slimiest, most powerful lawyers in the country of being a hitman?
Right.
And my reaction was, wow, what... fucked up shit are you into that you are worried about a hitman sitting behind you in a federal courtroom?
Exactly.
I learned so much about you just now, sir. So anyway, I was out of town doing that, but we won't talk about that.
No.
We're not going to talk about week three of the acting class that I teach at Hollywood Casting and Film.
Dying to hear about it.
We won't even preview this Thursday's sneak preview screening.
What?
Of the Lady Killers.
We're not even going to preview that.
No.
Because that's sold out, I'm sure.
Instead, well, it's a free sneak preview.
Oh, free.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's already packed.
Yeah. Yeah, they're waiting. They're all waiting.
Right now, sleeping overnight.
I mean, they're going to leave to say hi to you at the Lash Social for the Big and Tall show, and then they're going to come back. But all of these are things that we could talk about next week.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about a couple of very exciting different topics that are going to be of great interest to our listeners, I think,
mm-hmm.
and to us.
Right.
More importantly, to
us. Yeah.
Because it's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour,
and yet
it's our equipment.
That's
we have a special guest, and
right.
This is a guest that I have known since back from the days at UCLA.
What?
From the days of playing live-action role-playing games.
Wow.
And what's amazing is that the first live-action role-playing game I ever was involved with
right.
involved
Vampires.
The writings of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, you did a Cthulhu live.
Did. That was, and that's how I met this guest. And here we are, a few years later, a few years removed from that.
Perhaps.
And our guest today actually spends his life involved in a very exciting project pertaining to H.P. Lovecraft and utilizing live-action role-playing in a very, very exciting way. So let's welcome Aaron Vanek.
Hey, Aaron, how are you?
Good. Excellent.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Please enjoy an organic chocolate peanut butter cookie.
I've been enjoying that.
Pressure on the
Many
other,
of them.
You haven't enjoyed that one.
That's right. They're
Can
not,
I just?
I would say that, I would lie to you and say they're low calorie, but they're not.
I'll just sit and chew right in front of the microphone.
Yes.
Oh my goodness!
Mm, how many times?
How
we
good they are.
We do get that complaint, and, yeah. and honestly, at yeah. this point, one, I'm too old to care, but two, seriously, how much do you pay to listen to the podcast?
That's horrible. It's a free podcast.
So, Aaron, what? First of all, let's start off with a very exciting event coming up, I believe, very beginning of May. Is
yeah.
this not correct?
Yeah, May 1st to 3rd.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. What's that going to be?
It's the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and Cthulhu Con.
What?
Yes.
Where's that going to be?
It's down in San Pedro.
Uh-huh.
We're going to be showing films at the Warner Grand Theater.
Oh,
the fabulous
beautiful.
Warner Grand Theater. Yes. Opened in 1931. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
Love this theater. So we'll be there Friday night and Saturday night. And then Sunday, we're over at Crafted. The Marketplace, which is about a mile away. We'll have our Cthulhu Prayer Breakfast and an art show and more movies and games and just a whole bunch of madness.
I come dressed as Cthulhu?
That'd be great. We have had people do that, but it's not required.
Right.
Just the ticket.
So this isn't the first annual Cthulhu film?
No, this is our sixth.
Sixth,
yeah. And we moved it. We originally were at the end of September, but we moved it. In relation to the festival started 20 years ago, hard to believe, 20 years ago in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
And I was one of the first filmmakers there to get started. And, you know, I've been part of the Portland Festival for 20 years.
Right.
And decided to open one up down here in Southern California.
Yeah.
And that was 6 years ago, and it's been going 6 years strong since then. So it's really amazing.
Wow. Well, now take me back to 20 years ago. What was the film that was Lovecraft related? I'm sure that's the criteria to get in on the film festival, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the story of what happened was, you know, it, way back when, in the midst of time, in the early internet days.
Tell me, Grandpa, about the early internet.
I was going to graduate film school at Columbia College, Chicago.
Yep.
And a huge Lovecraft fan, been a fan since high school, playing the role-playing game and reading the stories. And there was a website run by a gentleman named Andrew Migliori that listed all the Lovecraft movies. And just kind of reviewed them and rated them. So it was Reanimator and From Beyond and
right.
Dunwich Horror and all the Lovecraft films, and you said, you know, good, bad, whatever.
Right.
And going through the list, I'm like, seen it, but there was one movie on that entire list that I had not seen, and it was an adaptation of The Music of Eric Zahn, one of Lovecraft's classic stories, and I'm like, I have not seen this.
I was going to guess the Roger Corman Fantastic Four. That's what I was going to guess. But instead...
Yeah, I actually saw that Roger Corman Fantastic Four. I was interning for Corman. I was there when that...
When they were
I saw the previous... Yeah, I saw it. It was pretty amazing.
Horrible.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
But so this one, Music of Eric Zahn, and it turns out the filmmaker, John Strizek, went to Columbia College Chicago when he did it. It was like his thesis film at the same school I was going to 10 years, 20 years before, 1980.
Right.
So I immediately emailed Andrew and said, how can I get this film? I want to see it. And oh, by the way, I happen to make a Lovecraft film myself as part of my student film adaptation of The Outsider, Lovecraft story, The Outsider.
Right.
So I adapted and I said, can I send you my film and put it on the list?
In
just because,
get a review.
Back in the days when, you know, having a listed on the internet was a huge deal. Like, I'm listed on a website.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm famous. Yeah.
Right. Everybody can read that.
So in the process of doing a VHS tape exchange between my movie and getting John's, John mentioned Andrew, said, look, if you got Aaron's The Outsider and My Eric Zahn, and you get a feature, you could run a film festival. This was John's idea to Andrew, and Andrew said, I'll do it. And that was the first year in 95.
Wow.
And it was...
Well, why Portland?
That's where he was living.
Andrew lived in Portland.
Okay, yeah, right. Andrew lived in Portland. I was in Chicago. John was in Los Angeles. And Andrew ran a used book website selling Lovecraft books and rare books. And
he wasn't with Powell's or anything, the famous.
No, which is go there every time I'm up in Portland, yeah, I go to Powell's.
Massive.
Oh, it's awesome. So we did this tiny little theater downtown, and it was the exact same program both nights. It was my film, The Outsider, John's music of Eric Zahn, and he got a movie called Necronomicon that was an anthology film that had Jeffrey Combs, and he actually flew the actor Jeffrey Combs up, and those were the guests. And it, you know, we didn't sell out, but it was just so much fun that Andrew decided to keep doing it.
Right.
So it's been 20 years. Andrew turned it over to some of the vendors, Brian and Gwen Callahan, after 13 years, I think, which is amazing. He went that, you know, before burning out.
Yeah, totally.
13 years. He's still involved with the company, and there was a DVD line that was coming out and books that he's done called Lurker in the Lobby that reviews all the Lovecraft films. So it's been really involved, and the festival has played in other places. Played in Texas. It's played in Providence, Rhode Island, Lovecraft's hometown. But we started the one down here in Southern California at the Warner Grand, and like I said, it's 6 years. So we're the young upstart.
So the Portland Festival still takes place?
Yes. They moved. We swapped dates. It's a long story, but in general, they were in the fall originally, but then in the switch when we started the Southern California one, we took the fall date and they moved to the spring May date. And now we switched back, and it's better for all of us.
Right. And is there any kind of... collaboration in terms of programming?
Sort of. If you want to submit films, we love getting films. It doesn't have to be a Lovecraft adaptation. It could be just a weird, creepy tale. You know, a lot of the films I really like are just kind of weird, bizarre, scary stuff.
Right.
That's not necessarily a Lovecraft adaptation.
But Lovecraft-inspired.
Or influenced.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But we have year-round submissions. And whichever film festival is closest to your submission looks
nice.
At it. And it goes through both. So if you submit your film, both festivals will take a look at it.
Oh, neat.
Will both festivals ever play some of the same films?
Yes, we have. We've definitely played the same films. We have one screen at the Warner Grand, and they have three at their theater in this great classic theater in Portland that's called the Hollywood Theater. Ironically, the Hollywood Theater in Portland.
How ironic.
Yeah. They have three screens, so they have much more programming time. So they'll take more stuff.
Right.
It's a little harder. But there's definitely films that we've both played that are really good. I mean, there's some amazing filmmakers from around the world, international, you know, stuff. And
yeah.
So what are you excited about for this forthcoming festival, either in terms of highlights of films or of events or guest speakers, anything?
Yeah, this year for the sixth one, we've themed it, and our theme this year is The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, one of Lovecraft's classic longest stories. It's like a short novel. And to go along with this theme, we're playing Roger Corman's The Haunted Palace from 1963, starring Vincent Price.
Wow.
It's got Lon Chaney in it, and I think Richard Matheson wrote the screenplay, which is amazing.
And that's not the one they used the other set, like the set was about to be torn down, so they all just came...
And that
was the crow. Peter Lorre was a talking crow in that one. Is that that
no,
one?
No, not that, that one. One. I think it probably.
But when you say the Roger Corman film that used the set from another movie, you're not narrowing it down.
Yeah, it's true.
How many movies can we shoot on this set before we have to dismantle it?
Yeah, you're breaking down one end and going on the other. No, interning for Roger Corman was definitely an experience. We showed this before about 4 years ago, The Haunted Palace, and we gave him the Howie Award, like the annual award for contributions to Lovecraft cinema. It's called Howie.
Oh,
it's
cool.
A full figure of H.P. Lovecraft, sculpted by Brian Moore. So shout out to Brian Moore.
Wow.
We gave it to Roger because this was the first cinematic adaptation of a Lovecraft work, 1963, that we know of. If anyone can prove that Lovecraft was adapted before Corman's, you know, Haunted Palace, you know, prove it.
Right.
So we're showing that because it's based on Case of Charles Dexter Ward. And then the one that's really awesome that we're showing is the director's cut of Dan O'Bannon's The Resurrected. So Dan O'Bannon, the screenwriter of Alien and Total Recall, He was a huge Lovecraft fan, and he adapted The Case of Charles Dexter Ward as his film called The Resurrected, starring Chris Sarandon. And it's amazing. What happened, it was going to be distributed by Orion, but Orion went out of business. So this is 99, I guess.
Yeah.
And it went straight to video. And the producers completely cut up the movie and changed it, and Dan felt really bad about it. He hated it. It was like, I love this. This was my best work to date.
Oh.
And they just completely butchered it. So Dan passed away probably about 4 years ago of Crohn's disease, and his wife Diane is coming up, and she's like, yeah, I have a director's cut. And I'm like, I would like to see that. So it's the director's cut. It's this, like, the music's not done, but it's Dan's cut of The Resurrected, what he actually wanted. Whoa. So we'll be showing that. Diane's coming up, and she'll be talking about it, and Dan's work and stuff like that. So that's going to be Saturday night and completely amazing.
Wow, that's pretty rare.
You know, a rare. It's yeah, you're not going to see this.
Yeah,
like ever.
That's
probably
amazing. Now, So I have read one H.P. Lovecraft novel, and I don't think I finished it. So now I feel like I am out of my depth here. Why? What? How many things did he write? Give me a
Many of the things that you're talking about when you're talking about adaptations, and that's what's, and this is surprising to me to learn that 63 was the first adaptation, because you know, so many short stories, and short stories, people I don't think who don't make film, maybe don't appreciate this fact, because, boy, you can't, you know, go to a movie theater without seeing, you know, based on the best-selling novel, based on the best-selling novel, based on the best-selling novel. But in terms of getting quality work out of something, right, it's actually much easier to structure a screenplay from a short story than it is from a novel. It's, you know, it's just for some reason that jumping-off process. And so it's surprising to me that nobody, because he had a wealth of short stories for, you know, in the beginning in the pulps, yeah, right? Yeah. In all the pulp magazines.
Yeah, Lovecraft lived from 1890 to 1937. He died at 47 of stomach cancer. And his peak of writing was 20s and 30s. Uh-huh. In the pulp, weird tales, astounding stories, and things like that. But he never got the recognition in his life as a popular writer. He was like a writer's writer. So other writers like Robert Bloch, author of Psycho, and August Derleth, and all these other writers were fans of his work.
Right.
L. Ron Hubbard was a big fan. So
yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. He wrote about 67, 68 short stories of varying lengths, Case of Charles Dexter Ward being a very long short story or a very short novella.
Right,
that length, and a couple other ones.
Did that originate in a magazine as well? Or
The Case of Charles Dexter Ward? Yes, he wrote it, and it wasn't published, I think, and I'm probably wrong on this. I don't think it was published when he was alive. I think a lot of his stuff was published after his death.
Right.
Serialized, I think.
Right.
But his work, the problems with adapting his work, one is that the copyright has been in question. And the number one question I get all the time is, what is it in public domain? Is copyright? And and it keeps going around on that. He didn't have any heirs. He was married, but he didn't have any children. And there's definitely a question when he died at a young age, 47, what happened to the copyright. And the copyright back then, the rule was you had to renew it every 25 years or something.
Yeah.
And there's no evidence that his stuff was renewed. Uh-huh. So some companies will claim that they have copyright on his stuff, but if you investigate, you know, go through a process, you won't necessarily see it. But everyone worries about it. What is the copyright? Right. So no one's really done anything, you know, on it or challenged it, but they still question it. The second thing is, a lot of his stories were written for a literature. They're written on a literary bent. They're not cinematically structured. If you look at sort of the plot, the structure, it's a lot of like internal monologue. The climax is the realization. It is a just a realization of a memory. It's not an action. He didn't write action stuff.
He didn't blow up the ship or anything like that.
Well, they did have Cthulhu blowing up, but it didn't happen. There wasn't a lot of it.
And that really, am I wrong in thinking that kind of set him apart, among other things, but that set him apart because at that time, weren't most of the pulp stories, it was all plot.
It was all plot. Action and plot.
And if you could imagine a plot and quickly commit it to paper, boy, you were getting assignment after assignment back then.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the pulp stuff was very pulpy, you know, dun-dun-dun. So his stuff was very different. He was rejected a lot of times because he didn't have really deep characters, and he was very much mood and atmosphere and tone and sort of this overall sort of cosmic background radiation of, you know, I say nihilism in some degrees, but it was sort of this overall dread feeling. It wasn't necessarily a lot of times a very hard, oh, and here's the bad guy, and we defeat the bad guy, or we don't defeat the bad guy, and right. And there we go. His stuff was much more cerebral, it was much more intellectual, it was much more kind of a deeper, I don't really know what's going on, but it's bad. It hints to the dread that we can all feel. It's like mankind is insignificant, you know, relation to the cosmos.
Right?
And he works with that trope often. It's you can't really do anything, so it's kind of like this ugly feeling in your stomach that, like, I don't really matter.
which really...
But cookies matter.
which was very ahead of its time. I mean, you would think that, you know, that would... Writing that way, yes. Oh, he must have written in the post-World War II. Must have been 1950s, right? 1960s, to have embodied that kind of feeling of dread and insignificance.
Because,
and
30s technically was a bit of a moment of, hey, men can do anything with their architecture and our abilities. And
we could do anything, but we couldn't destroy everything.
Right.
At the same time, right? Yeah, and then you get, after World War II, wow, we can't really do anything because we keep making the same mistakes over and over again, but now we can destroy everything.
Right, which is much more dreadful.
It definitely, I think, was inspired by the World War I, the Great War. At the time, the first mechanized war with mustard gas and all this stuff. And the discoveries, Lovecraft definitely was in touch with the modern science of the day,
right.
Whatever it was. So Einstein's theory of relativity, all that was informing him. He wanted to be an astronomer. He wanted to be an astronomer. He was heavily into the science. He would have loved to do it, but he just didn't have the mathematics ability to do it.
Right.
But he was heavily involved with whatever scientific exploration
and
stuff, space-time, and one of his classic stories, The Mountains of Madness, takes place in Antarctica, and the expeditions and exploration of untold realms, you know, down the continent. So he was definitely thinking, all scientifically, I guess, without necessarily the hard science, mathematics background.
Right.
But it definitely informed a lot of his fiction.
Oh, cool. And so when people adapt these short stories now in the film festivals, are they going to that same science and nihilism and all that sort of thing?
Yeah.
What are you looking for? Like when you get submissions?
Yeah, there's definitely a mix of stuff that come into that. And so there's straight adaptations, you know, of some of the stories. And then there's ones that are... have the feel of and inspired by and the atmosphere and tone, and some of them are absolutely that sort of feeling, and that's what I prefer, just as one of the directors. So the hint that I tell people is, I kind of want to see, after 20 years of seeing these films, I want to see what scares you as a filmmaker, as a director or a screenwriter, and how you're going to kind of take the tropes and atmosphere and tone and ideas of Lovecraft and channel it through yourself, through your own fears and nightmares, and bring that to me. Because I've read all the stories. I know the plot. So if you're going to do another adaptation, then I'm just comparing it. I'm like, oh, they cut this scene where this happened, or, oh, that's how they did this scene that I'm so familiar with. You know, I've seen so many times.
Right.
So it's just kind of a checklist, a lot of the stories. And there's about five or six of them that there's at least half a, you know, I'd say a dozen or more adaptations. So it's like, okay, you're doing it this way. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, you put a female as a lead. Well, that's different. That's new.
Right.
But the ones that really affect me that I like are the ones that, like, I don't know what's going to happen because it's not straight adaptation.
Right.
But it still has that feeling and atmosphere and tone.
Right.
Those are the ones that I personally love.
And so often we talk in the show about tone and the importance of tone. And it sounds like this is sort of a festival of tone, more than just straight adaptations.
Well, speaking about the festival itself, stepping away from the artistry of the films and the filmmakers, what are some of the, not necessarily even specific to it being Lovecraft, but what have you found are some of the biggest challenges in running a festival, in running a film festival.
True, because that's on our list.
And maybe they are because of the unique nature of Lovecraft. Maybe some of the challenges relate to that. But yeah, what are some of the biggest ones?
The challenges of running a film festival. How long is this podcast?
Let's fill that up.
It's
because these, I feel like this list will certainly embody the spirit of Lovecraft. Can you already feel the dread?
And the nihilism.
It's very difficult to organize something of this nature and this scale. And we get, you know, we're averaging 500 people, you know, which is not a lot. We're definitely a small festival, but that's still
a
bunch of people. And there's so many moving parts to a film festival. There's booking the location and getting insurance and getting the permits and where's parking. There's the marketing of the festival, doing podcasts and getting ads and, you know, spreading postcards around and postcards around. There's handling the filmmakers, selecting the films, getting the screening version from the filmmaker, letting them know, getting special guests, making deals with the hotels, making sure the green room is stocked with wine and beer. We have after party venues. I'm dealing with that right now. You know, we have a bunch of vendors, so you can buy like Cthulhu shirts and goodies and stuff like that.
Cthulhu's. Yes,
so we have to deal with the vendors. We're setting up a program. You know, our program is really, you know, film festivals have their program of everything. Ours is a newspaper. And this was started in Portland. It's an actual newsprint out as a little newspaper from the 20s and 30s.
Oh, that's kind of neat.
So, you know, it harkens back to that situation. But we have to lay that out. We have to
So you don't have to like give people armbands and you don't have to give them passes. All you need is to have, you know, if you can show the ink stains on your fingers from the newsprint. Yep.
You're in.
He bought a pass.
You're in.
He bought a pass. He's in.
That's hilarious.
You're in.
Though I could see that being forged pretty easily.
You know, I actually wasn't seriously suggesting it. I don't run a film festival.
Oh right.
Yeah. So my advice in that regard should be very much taken with a grain of salt.
We have somewhat more better security that they just throw the the voting, you know, the purple thumb of voting.
You have Cthulhu security. I mean, that's not to be trifled with.
The great old ones will not let you in with just ink-stained fingers. It's a lot of moving parts, essentially.
And it's year-round, right? I mean, you take all year to get this one festival together.
Yeah, this year, because we switched dates, so our last one in 2014 was the end of September. This was a fast turnaround because we switched dates. Now, we knew this was coming, and so it's like, oh, you know, we're going to have to move fast, but you know, we pretty much shut down, you know, went dark after last year's fest, and we got all our, because we had a Kickstarter, we had to do Kickstarter stuff, so once we got all the fulfillment out, we shut down, you know, and so October, November, December, we're not doing anything. Suddenly January comes like, oh, we should start thinking about, we have a month to do a Kickstarter. And everything had to be rushed this year. Because it was, you know, a fast turnaround.
Yeah.
Usually there's a year between them. Right. And, you know, gives you enough time to relax and start thinking about, you know, who are our big guests, what is our theme, and we get the films. But it's good on the plus side after 6 years. We've done it so many times. I've done this five times, that we kind of know the routine.
Yeah.
I know the routine. It's been the same theater. They know us. We know them. We know how to talk the language. We get a lot of funding from the San Pedro Business Improvement District, sort of like the Chamber of Commerce in the historic area of San Pedro. So I know how to pitch things for that. So it's like filmmaking or anything else.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any easier. You just get more experienced in solving the problems that come up every time.
Right.
Yeah. Does that then also lend itself, like with filmmaking often, to then saying, okay, we figured out how to crack that nut. Now what new challenge can we bring on?
Yeah.
Right. So you're going to expand every year, the other years you saw.
Create a new, not necessarily crisis, but even if it's not expanding, you know, what can we bring in to the pre-existing, you know, infrastructure of it? What kind of event? What kind of panel?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's exactly the way that I ran it. I didn't want to start doing everything at once. In other words, the Portland Festival started out as 3 films, 2 shorts and 1 feature, same programming Friday night and Saturday night. And then it slowly expanded to Sunday, more films, it didn't repeat, et cetera, et cetera. So the first year, from the San Pedro Fest. It was called Los Angeles then. It was H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival Los Angeles. It was just kind of a best of. I didn't really take any new submissions. It was one day, Saturday, for about 6 hours, I think. Then we went to 2 days, and then we went to 3 days. And so I generally expanded slowly because I want to make sure that we get, you know, we know we got all this stuff solid.
Right.
And then we'll start doing some more stuff. So, but there's new things that we're trying. Last year, we just did a secret screening. It was our first year. So after Saturday night, it's like those who dare to challenge their sense and sensibilities with the madness of Lovecraft can come to an undisclosed location.
Wow.
And we show movies and we don't announce. And it goes to like dawn.
God.
And it's like horror. Yeah, it's horrible horror things that are really bad. So it went great, and we're going to do it again this year.
Wow.
Secret screening.
That would blow my mind.
I was curious a little bit, going back a moment, about maybe some of the influences, the literary influences that Lovecraft had, if you know of any of those. Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking about how, you know, those years when he was writing. And also, you mentioned Jeffrey Combs. I was thinking about how we saw, and maybe you did as well, Jeffrey Combs do his one-man Poe.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, and I was curious as whether, you know, what kind of influence Poe was.
Poe was probably Lovecraft's number one influence. Definitely, he says that it was his number one influence. It's arguable if it was, but absolutely, Edgar Allan Poe was a huge influence on H.P. Lovecraft. But it's also the classic authors before then. He had a huge Lord Dunsany influence, Algernon Blackwood, M.R. James,
wow,
Arthur Macon, I always mispronounce it, so apologize. Right.
he's not listening.
Yeah, yes, well, fortunately.
He might be.
If you, there's an essay you could get for free. It's actually a very good essay. It's a critical look at horror literature that Lovecraft wrote called Supernatural Horror in Literature. And it's free, and he basically explores horror literature. It's one of the first people to kind of look at it critically, with a critical eye.
Yeah, yeah.
And he mentions a lot of the authors that he was fans of. And the opening to Supernatural Horror in Literature, which is just great, and it's quoted all the time, Lovecraft says, the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of emotion, kind of fear, is fear of the unknown.
Right.
So he says that fear is the biggest emotion of man, and fear of the unknown is the greatest type of fear.
I would say again, though, Lovecraft didn't live long enough to see the ice capades. I would like to point that out.
You fear the ice capades?
Oh, dear Lord, don't you?
I never got to see the monkey on ice. His feet were always frozen.
Aaron.
I went every year. Every year.
There's your life. There's your Lovecraft film. There's the monkey on
the
ice.
The monkey on ice.
He's never there. It's
like, oh my God! From the X-Files, Dean Haglund comes the monkey on ice. That like so is.
But it's the monkey that's never there. He's only in the program. There's a picture of a monkey.
Honestly,
in the
you ought to do your one man Lovecraft show.
Really?
The monkey on ice. The monkey. Improv on ice. Lovecraft.
Be scared.
Comedy.
Oh, is there a live venue in this hill?
There is. We do take live stuff. We have we're going to be doing a burlesque show.
What?
We have a drag king show. Yeah. So we do live stuff. We have a live radio drama, audio drama,
right,
by Macabre Fantasy Radio Theater.
Oh, cool.
Are coming in.
These actual scripts, Lovecraft scripts?
No. They're adapting. It's on our website. It's an M.R. James story and an Edward Bulwer Lytton story. I forget which ones they are, but they're doing a double feature.
Oh,
and
cool.
So it's basically you have the cast on stage,
yeah,
in front of the microphones and foleying the sounds and everything,
thing,
and it's all live.
Oh,
yeah,
fantastic.
It's awesome.
What is the website? We'll link it, obviously, in the descriptions, but at this point, people are probably listening to this show, and they're thinking, I wonder what the website is. So what is the website?
We're changing websites, which is another thing. So why don't you go to, this is the easiest, hplfilmfestival.com is the easiest, hplfilmfestival.com. But that's the old site. If you go to the new site,
what's that
is CthulhuCon.com, and that's CthulhuCon.com, CthulhuCon. And if you want tickets to the San Pedro Festival, it's at hplffsp.bpt.me.
Wow.
It's brown paper tickets. So if you just go into brown paper tickets and look for Lovecraft Film Festival, you'll find it.
You got it there.
Might I suggest that some of the challenges could be...
It's like truth-is out there.
No, our website. There's nothing wrong with our website
it's
at all.
A lot
all.
Of dashes.
Yeah, you know, we're just like that brown paper ticket site he just riddled yeah. off. We also are not selling any tickets to the Lovecraft Fest.
Oh, that's true.
You'll find it. I mean, if you
you'll
do
find
a
it.
Yeah,
brown paper tickets. And look
really,
at
just search Google Lovecraft Film Festival, and you'll find it.
There you go.
So, Aaron, so you went to film school. You made a Lovecraft film. Do you still
Children.
Have the time? Have the opportunity? To write and to make films yourself?
I haven't. I was trying to do the big career in film, you know, for years and years since then, and haven't lately. And I said, no, I'm out of the film business. Hate it, Hollywood. But never say never. There's a script that I've had that's a Lovecraft adaptation. It's based on some stuff that I've had for years from a guy. It's a modern day one. It's paced well and everything. And actually, it's by Delta Green, which is a role-playing game supplement, and it's like X-Files meets Cthulhu.
Oh, cool.
To say. And it's a really awesome script, and I'm like, I would love to make this. And I said no, because at the time when I was looking at it, it was before Kickstarter and crowdfunding, and I'm like, where are we going to get $30,000, $50,000 that's just kind of going to go away?
Right.
But now, like a year later, Kickstarter came out when I had it, and so I'm like, I'm really just now actually talking about, like, the writer of it, and like, could we do this again? Because I really like this script. It's a short, it'd be like half hour.
Oh, cool.
So no, I haven't done any film work. I've concentrated on the film festival and then games and LARPing and other interactive art forms.
Right, right.
Well, I was wondering. Now you mentioned LARPing, and I talked about how we met doing a Cthulhu LARP.
Right.
In hearing your description about Lovecraft's writing and about, again, how it's about tone and not about necessarily, you know, the clearly defined character, is that why it serves so well as the inspiration for these games? Because you then get to find your character within it, as opposed to playing
a character
that is already so well defined
and written out for
you. It's like you got to reprise Sherlock Holmes or something like that.
The werewolf.
Whereas you're, in this case, you're limited only by your own creativity.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's just the appeal to Lovecraft in general. And I was talking about this at a panel on Saturday at the San Diego Library about Lovecraft for the film festival, that when Lovecraft's writing, he essentially left gaps in it. In other words, he wouldn't describe everything in exacting detail for the reader to just kind of see passively. He left gaps. He said things were mysterious and unnameable and unknowable and who knows what's going on. He left a lot of that in there.
Right.
So my feeling is that those gaps get filled in by the reader or, you know, the player or whatever. And so because you put some of yourself into it, it's far more personal. You're motivated in it, and it's more real because you have filled in the gaps. It's the closure sense that humans have. You know, if you look at a wall socket, it looks kind of like a face. You know, I see two eyes and the mouth.
Oh, yeah.
When people are putting this sense of closure into the story and into the characters and filling in the details from their own interpretation, it's much closer. It's much more real. And so I think that appeal, that's to me the strongest appeal of Lovecraft, is that he wrote just enough of, created enough dots for you to connect, and then you realize the great horror yourself. He didn't reveal it to you. You discovered it.
Oh,
you know,
cool.
you have a sense of discovery reading his stuff rather than, here, I'm just going to tell you what's going on.
Right. And then does that happen in the LARPs as well, that you discover your own horror?
Yeah. A lot of times, I mean, there's been a bunch of Lovecraft live-action role-playing stuff, and I think it's just the mystery and the horror and that personal sense of fear, again, atmosphere and tone.
Right, right.
You know, it lends itself so well to creating that.
Totally.
Sort of experience.
And will there be one during the film festival, a LARP?
No, there isn't. I wish there was.
Yeah.
We are doing gaming on Sunday at Crafted, but it's board games and card games and the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game and stuff. So
right,
it's definitely welcome. I would love if someone were like, we want to do a LARP. And there's been rough analogies, and I would be the one to do it. It's just I cannot run a LARP and a film festival at the same time, but really want one.
Right.
It just hasn't happened. So if any of your listeners make LARPs and want to do one, get in touch with me.
Listeners.
Yes.
I mean, Dean Haglund doesn't necessarily listen to the show, but he does host it. And
I LARP.
You LARP. You've been known to run a LARP or two in your day.
Well, yeah, but those were run without me because I was the key component to an X-Files LARP in Atlanta over 31 stories of the hotel. So I was the hidden gem in hallways and in rooms and bathrooms and stairwells. So, yeah, it was a long game. I'm not going to lie to you.
Wait a minute. No, what you're describing that year, that there was no LARP that year.
What was I doing in the stairwell?
You really, really tied one on.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really got to look back at that video.
But there's something fascinating. So, you know, I love this conversation about live-action role-playing, but you... Actually, this is not just something that's a hobby or something that's even related to some of your other interests, but I mean, this is something that you use really in an incredibly beneficial way for people. You use it as an educational tool.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so the other thing I do, I say there's three things that I know in life, and this is true. Okay. I know about liquor. Because I was blogging about cocktails for 4 years, so I know liquor, I know Lovecraft, and I know LARP. I know three L's, and that's it. I don't know anything else about anything else.
Let me tell you about the three L's.
Yes, LARP, Lovecraft, and liquor. And they work together great, because Prohibition, and so I knew all Prohibition cocktails.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So live-action role-playing, I've been involved in that since, you know, I was a kid, since I was playing Dungeons & Dragons, and... You know, and it was a lot of fun. I did it when I was at UCLA, UCLA's Enigma, you know, where Phil and I met. And I've gone on since 2006, I would say. And I sort of discovered in the Nordic countries, Finland, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, they're like really progressive and doing art, social change, really deep live-action role-playing events and experiences.
Thank you. Thank you, by the way, for defining the Nordic countries, because I am an American, and I don't care what's outside my borders.
Yes.
You knew, because you hail from Canada.
Right, so we go to Sweden and stuff. Yeah.
No. Yes. The Northern European countries.
Right.
And they've been doing stuff that I thought, like, Enigma was kind of leading towards, and they've used it for education, as a pedagogy for education. And
really?
I read about it, and essentially there's a school in Denmark that I've been to, and I talked to the headmaster, and their entire curriculum is LARP-based. So if you go to this school, and it's like a high school, so 9th, 10th grade, you're going to be in a LARP every day of your school year.
What?
And the kids love it. And they don't want to leave. Like, they'll have a Christmas break. They don't go home. They don't go anywhere. They go, no, I want to stay at school.
Because they're going to lose.
No, they have a 0% graduation rate.
They're all
send me back. Hold me back.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So wait a sec. They're using the LARP as an educational tool. So they're actually getting all the curriculum in, but... I keep one character through all the years?
No, they do a whole bunch of... They do theme weeks. Their system, which I do, is that each week is a theme. So, for example, one was a CSI, or police procedural, I should say.
Right.
Sort of a CSI. So the kids played police detectives in teams, like four-person teams, I guess, trying to find a serial killer.
Right.
And, you know...
And biology and anatomy.
Right.
And you detect a frog.
What they did... Well, what they did that was so amazing is, in chemistry...
They had them investigate real crimes.
Right. Yes.
But they didn't tell them. They were after real serial killers.
Real yes, right.
And that's the basis of Ender's Game.
Yes. Going after the real criminals in Denmark.
In Denmark. That's hilarious.
Next week, we have a LARP that we're going to be doing called Balancing the Budget.
I think they've done that.
That's hilarious.
But what they did, just to kind of give the example of how you use LARPing, is they had a chemistry lecture on acids. One of the victims was killed like in an acid bath. The body dissolved in an acid bath, because the rules on like violence and gore in Denmark is way different than in America.
Right.
So the teacher, who's their regular chemistry teacher, was given the lecture about pH and acid bases and all that stuff. And it was pretty much straight up, except that there was this patina of the kids were actually police cadets, and this was an expert called in to consult with them. So when the teacher came in and goes, "Hello, cadets, I am so-and-so, character name,
right,
and I'm here to consult with you about acids and bases for some reason, I don't know. So here we go," and just launched into a regular
class.
Lecture.
Yeah.
But the students were paying attention because they wanted that information because they wanted to figure out
who did it.
Yeah, because they were competing.
Clue. Yeah.
Groups were competing with each other. So they wanted to get that information. But otherwise, it was a straight up chemistry lecture, just with this narrative story. And so my belief is that because LARPs work so well on an emotional level, right? It's the one thing I think of that gives you a physical workout because, you know, you're running around and a lot of times in fantasy you're swinging a foam sword.
Right.
An intellectual one because you're trying to solve puzzles and deal with something, but also an emotional workout. And that's very rare because in most forms of entertainment, books or movies or something like that, you're passive. And someone else, I mean, there's catharsis and stuff, and it's amazing, but you don't get in a LARP to just watch Luke Skywalker. You get to be Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia and experience that stuff. You know, you don't watch James Bond, you know, with the girls. You actually get that shaken, not stirred martini yourself and taste it. And so it adds this emotional experience. To that, I say emotional.
So you're saying they're giving martinis to these kids. Is that, am I getting this
right? No. Maybe they do that.
That would be very, very Denmark.
That's at your school because you are a cocktail mixologist.
Yes, that's right. What's the drinking age in Denmark? Yeah. But the emotional baggage, if you have learning attached to emotion, you'll retain it better.
Yes.
If you
physicality. You embody it, if you put it in your body, I teaching this acting class, and I have a wide range of experience in the acting class, and some of these people are filmmakers in my class, and one of them is so outraged because of the amount of material I expect her to memorize in a week's time. Yeah, because we as filmmakers never ask anyone else to memorize at the last minute a lot of stuff.
Right.
So, wow, you know. But the other thing about it was because she's coming at it from a filmmaker and not from an actor, she doesn't understand that it's not memorization. Right? Learning lines is not memorization. You get it into your body.
It's embodiment.
You connect with the emotional reality of the character. You get the words into the body, but the character, if you find it, knows the words.
Yeah.
And so it is this kind of, way of learning something as opposed to studying it, learning it by rote, needing it because you have to answer a question. No, there's a stake involved in it.
Yeah.
A personal stake, and that's what's
so amazing.
And I've got to think one of the most exciting things because, you know, everything in this country and maybe other countries as well, I don't know, but so much about standardized testing. And you can see at even early age, so many kids get frustrated and then the light goes off.
Right.
Because, I'm just stupid.
Right.
Or I just can't learn. Or I can't. And no, maybe we failed you, because we haven't helped you find your way of learning.
Yeah. So, and this sounds really exciting. This sounds like the solution to the entire learning system.
Yeah,
in North America.
I believe that in my heart, but I want to get data on it. I want to get proof that it is. Now, I know for a fact that the motivation of live action role playing is off the charts.
Yeah.
Like kids love, hands down, they all love to learn this way.
When getting data on it in order to prove it, do you pretend you're a laboratory technician getting data?
No, I don't. You're going to be a lab tech. You're going to be a scientist. No, it's got to be, third party, independent party, get before and after, qualitative, quantitative, PhD
and
stuff. And it's unfortunate, but the idea is that if the kids can learn and actually retain this stuff at equal or better level than traditional learning, yeah, then absolutely. This is the holy grail of educational, ability.
Right.
And looking at what they're doing in Denmark, at least those kids love it. And they learn. What I've found running these games is that it gets intrinsic motivation. They want to learn this because they want to do better in the game.
Right.
They want to compete. I've had 8th grade girls in an urban school begging me for get this, math problems. They wanted me to give math problems because I set up a game where they could attack another team if they solved this math question correctly. And the group of boys like threw a little paper ball at them and they're like, give me more math problems, because then they could attack the boys team. So I'm just sitting here, these girls in this inner urban thing are like, no, you got to put more problems up on the board. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll give you more math problems.
Wow.
You know, it's insane.
Yeah,
and the level of engagement, empowerment, all this stuff is in there. The headmaster of the school in Denmark that I've been to said, our belief is that in role playing, when you role play characters, that you should give the kids all the options, open all the doors of careers to them. Oh, anything right. they want, let them close those doors.
Right.
So if you get a kid who doesn't know math or science, play a scientist.
Right.
And it's like, I don't know math or science. That's okay, just play a scientist. You're going to role play a scientist.
Right.
And they're role playing it and they're kind of thinking about it, and we treat them, the teachers and everyone treats them as a scientist, they might go, I actually really kind of like this.
Right.
And they're motivated because they want to know about whatever, astronomy or biology or whatever. They just like that field, that they then might be motivated to do the science and the math and get into it.
Wow.
Because right now, everything is compartmentalized in America, and you just get a math class devoid of context.
Right.
It's just, if you like math, you'll love math. If you don't like math, why would you
right.
care about math class?
You've come to the wrong place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And algebra is so abstract. X equals what? Like,
yeah.
what? Like, I know so many kids that could not wrap their head around it, like the concept of X. Just like, it's
yeah.
what? So, yeah,
but
I can
if
see
you
that
put
we put
it in,
into a thing.
We put it in. We did one game where they had to build a lever based on an ancient invention called a shaduf that the Egyptians used to move water from the Nile. But it's basically
right.
just a basic lever.
Right.
And we had them build it, the students, and then we gave them the science after they built it.
Uh-huh.
And so this one girl said, oh, I got to use math. All my math teachers say, you'll use math later in life. And she's like, I want to use it now. And she finally did. And the next day, she built a thing, and then we asked them to improve it, and we said, and here's the science and the math behind improving it. And then she goes, oh, okay, because there was a contextual reason for
right.
her to learn it. And
right.
that's the kind of, you know, pedagogy and curriculum that live action role playing can do for education.
See, that's brilliant. Now, how far are you taking this? Are you like moving into like trying to show USDA or US LA USD?
The US Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
my dogs.
Goodness.
I got
We've
my
got,
dogs on my head.
Here's our new LARP. Mad cow disease.
I would play that.
Yes. So the question, yes, how far have you gone with this? Also, where can people learn more about what you're doing with this?
So I started a nonprofit company called Seekers Unlimited. That's a 501c3 that's done 17 games for four different schools, I think.
Wow.
I think it is. So you could just go to seekersunlimited.org. It's all one word, seekers, plural, unlimited.org, and can see some of the programs there. But there's a lot of other groups using this. It's not always called live action role playing, but like Mock Trials, the Model UN Club.
Right.
These are all LARPs in my mind.
Right, right.
College level history, there's a great program from Barnard called Reacting to the Past, where you're reenacting like historical stuff.
Cool. Yeah.
It's not a reenactment, I should say, because they'll take the premise, but then history depends on what the kids do.
Right.
So everything's real as we know it up to point A, and then when the game starts, all bets are off,
right.
and you can do
generally
whatever.
Could win.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So I'm looking to create
could.
More games.
And did, but we'll talk about the truth behind that next week.
Oh my gosh. Oh no. That's civil war.
By the way, I it's important to point out that I've had a plate of cookies and
oh, yeah.
Aaron mixed us Prohibition era cocktails.
No.
So
yeah.
I just,
where did I get
yeah,
those?
Up, yeah.
Well, I didn't get mine.
Which downtown.
So please, I'm sorry. Please continue with this is fantastic.
So ultimately hoping to make more games and get those games out, you know, into the market, so teachers anywhere can be running this stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
And getting it. So
and that's Seekers?
Seekersunlimited.org.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I want to go back to school and play one of these things.
Yeah. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, seeing it and seeing the involvement of the kids. They're excited to do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, get it really chaotic. That's one of the hard things that has to overcome with teachers. There's a little bit of resistance because
it seems completely out of control.
Yeah, exactly. But it isn't, because they're all kind of involved in the thing. And what happens, if you think of traditional learning, it's about one person lecturing, and you have to sit there and take notes and be quiet. Don't talk, don't move, just sit in your desk and take these notes. In live action role playing, you're up, you're moving, you're talking to other people, you're arguing with other people, you're debating with them, and so the classroom gets loud, kids are moving, and you think it's complete mess. But it's so energized, it's so motivated, the kids are just loving it,
right.
And they're learning, because there's this element of gamifying, it's called, right. Sort of a bad term, but this element of like, I am this person that I've embodied, this character, and this character wants these things, so I want these things, and one of the things I want is to know this solution to this puzzle, or whatever, that happens to be a science thing.
Ah.
You know, and you get the fictional element. We've had them, you know, play crew of a spaceship. We did a noir one where they were detectives.
Oh my
trying
God.
To find, you know.
Okay, so now I got a marketing thing, because you know how always the film production companies and like the big studios are trying to get their movies into the kids? Make the movie franchise, the LARP to the educational thing. Then you're good.
Any movie studio wants to hire me to make the game, I'm right here.
I've seen like Marvel's Avenger World with the whole thing.
Well, Marvel did do that. They did a experience. The Marvel experience went around, and it was like, look at Thor's hammer and Captain America's shield and stuff like that.
Right, and the physics behind that.
Yeah, and there was this company, Game Desk, that we've done a bunch of work for, was doing the educational aspect of it. So before you went, because it was in a museum, before you went to the museum, you would get kind of the actual physics behind this stuff.
Right.
Before you went, you were like a pretend agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Uh-huh.
sort of situation. The kids were like a cadet of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something like that. Like Cub Scouts of S.H.I.E.L.D. Something like that.
Right.
But they would get that
physics and then go in.
And then go in and see the prop that the...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and you know, for a while, for many of us, live action role playing based on different comic book, you know, characters, genres, franchises, actually was far ahead in terms of, you know, quality storytelling, because it's only very recently that comic book film adaptations, for the most part, have been any good. I mean, there was always an outlier like Superman or what have you, but for the most part, you know, all through the 90s, it's not like there were good stories being told in a visual medium.
Right. They were just trying to copy the storyboard that was the comic book, not actually taking the essence of the comic book and creating a new project.
Right.
So it was just like, oh, hey, here's a pre-storyboarded movie, let's just shoot this comic book. And that's why they all sucked back then.
Yeah. Right, instead of creating a world and letting characters inhabit it.
Exactly. So...
Yeah.
So there we go. That sort of brings us to a fascinating end.
I mean, for almost 8 years, we have been live action role playing radio show.
Exactly.
Radio show.
One of these days, we're going to win.
No, we'll just keep fighting. We'll just keep fighting.
It just never ends. The cycle never ends.
So we will link to all these. Is there anything else? Anywhere else where people should find you? Or
are you
if they want
the movie festival?
No?
Is there tweeting?
Yeah, the Twitter's HPLFFLA. You can find me and all my information at aaronvanek.com. Just AaronVanek.com. So that's my stuff and everything that's going on. I did a LARP census, so survey the LARPers around the world. We got 30,000 responses.
Oh, my gosh.
So their motivations, why they do it, demographics, where they're from, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, cool. 90% just to have fun? Was that the...
Yeah, it was a lot of it. It's a sense of... The big thing is sense of community. It's really big one.
It's
like,
true.
For a lot of people, this is their... you know, family. They're they're not blood related family that
That's
they
true.
Go in and they show up with that. But it was really good, and we're still going into the data. You know, closed a couple months ago.
Oh, cool.
You can find so many installments of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. You can download them, you can stream them, you can subscribe via iTunes.
You can even write a review.
I believe within a week or two, every one of the more than 414 shows we have done will be available, thanks to our hosts at Blog Talk Radio.
Absolutely. And, big news, we'll be back on Jackalope Radio. They just emailed us all the new info.
Well, thank you, Jackalope Radio.
Yes.
Thank you, Stitcher. Thank you, who else am I?
Blog Talk.
Yeah, everybody. Look, you know what? I think it's safe to say that we can be found wherever good podcasts are available.
That's right.
All right. Write us, please. ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. That's C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood@yahoo.com. Follow us on Twitter. We are at...
Dean and Phil.
And while you're busy poking things on Facebook and playing Candy Crush Saga, please take time to like your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
It's so easy.
At Facebook.com.
And just as our cookies were organic...
/ Chill Pack Hollywood.
Yes.
And just as our cookies were organic, so too is our sponsor's line of petrol, Empire State Gas, organically grown from farm to pump. We've got great gas. Till next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.